This is Mike Dilt with the Relax Back UK show on UK Health Radio, your global real feel-good radio station. On the Relax Back UK show, we explore all kinds of health topics, so keep listening and enjoy the ride.
Hi, and thank you for joining me, Mike Dilk, on the Relax Back UK show. And I really do mean that. On UK Health Radio, there are 40,000 listeners to the show each week, and that's not including people that listen via the podcast. Shows are available as a podcast on Spotify and Apple, etc. All you do is just search for the Relax Back UK show, Relax Back, all one word, then a space, then UK. This week, the topic is something that affects millions of people, sometimes without them even knowing. It's diabetes. So dieting and eating the right food if you're a pre-diabetic can be very difficult indeed. Dr. Max Goland tells us about something that might make it a bit easier.
Broccoli seems to be the top of the tree in terms of its glucoraphanin content. So what's good about glucoraphanin? Well, there's been over 3,000 scientific papers published in the last 30 years or so on glucoraphanin from broccoli, showing very, very clearly, Mike, that it has a lot of health benefits.
Glucoraphanin and broccoli is good. Anthony Smith joins us as well. He was successful in not developing diabetes after being told he was pre-diabetic. Then listeners will know that I like technology and wearables, etc. And it turns out that they can be very handy for diabetic patients as well.
So this is where having data and being able to measure it, but also manage it, is going to be critical when you're dealing or helping a patient live with diabetes.
Jade Dagger is the global leader at Roche Diabetics, and he explains how. So this is important stuff. So please do stay tuned. Thank you.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
So we start off with Dr. Max Goland. He's an expert in diabetes, and Anthony Smith. He was pre-diabetic. He was told by his GP that he was pre-diabetic and that he needed to do something about it. And he did, in fact, manage to head it off at the pass. He didn't find it easy, but he was successful. So first off, I just got him to confirm that that was indeed the case.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Fantastic. All right, guys, look, thank you very much indeed for joining me. Kyle, I think the situation at the moment is if you get a warning that you're potentially pre-diabetic, most patients are then just told to change their diet and their lifestyle. Is that kind of pretty much the situation? That's what they're presented with. Is that the situation, isn't it, Max? I see you nodding.
It is. I mean, the problem is that with pre-diabetics, if you like, most of them are indeed told exercise and make sure you have a decent diet, not too much sugar in your diet. And sugar is bad to have in your diet, let's be honest. The problem is that most people don't really adhere to that. I don't know about you, Anthony, but a lot of people find it difficult. We know from scientific trials that losing weight can make a massive difference to diabetes, entering diabetes. We also know that exercise can make a massive difference. So it is the correct way to go forward and to try and not enter diabetes territory, because diabetes is a dangerous disease. It's not as laissez-faire as people think. It's a nasty disease. It can give rise to a lot of nasty things later in life.
Yeah.
Microvascular problems, heart problems, metabolic syndrome.
People have, you know, feet amputated and extreme eye problems and go blind. Diabetes is really nasty. And if you can avoid it, it's really worth avoiding. So it's kind of this strange dichotomy, isn't it? If people are told, right, you've got a pretty good chance of getting diabetes, you need to do this. But a lot of us don't do it. So, and, you know, most people are perfectly rational human beings and capable of thought. So what's going wrong, Max? Why don't we follow the advice?
Well, you know, exercising, certainly as you get a little bit older, is not everyone's cup of tea. I mean, I love exercise and I go to the gym 3 times a week, etc. That doesn't mean to say I'll never get diabetes, but it will lower my risk without a doubt. And eating healthily, again, it's too tempting. You know, too many high sugar, high fat processed foods. It's easy to get a takeaway pizza, blah, 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 and it goes on. So yeah. it's, you know, exercise is only enjoyable to some people. In fact, a lot of people hate it. And eating unhealthily is actually quite nice to a lot of people. And both of those are bad things. And both of those are a recipe for disaster, let's be honest.
Of course. Well, let's bring in Anthony, because, you know, you've been through this, haven't you, Anthony? So yes. Did your doctor say to you, look, this is the situation, and did you try and change your lifestyle and your habits of a lifetime?
Well, what would happen, I would have regular sort of blood tests done, and then they would get my, that would include the HbA1c test, to test, obviously, for my blood glucose levels. And I would get a text message saying you're pre-diabetic, and there will be a link to an article to read. And I'm not blaming my GP or my GP surgery because they're very busy. But then there was never any follow-up. And I'd like to think, you know, I'm somebody who is quite well-educated and fairly intelligent. But I never responded to really to those text messages when they came. I'd read but wouldn't follow it up. And it was only actually when I was unwell earlier this year and my GP suggested actually, you know, your HbA1c levels are high. It was 45. I found out subsequently it had been higher at 46. You in fact, at first they thought it was 45. And they said, actually, you may have gone up. You may be diabetic now. And I had another blood test.
So those are markers for diabetes.
Yes. And actually, the number had fallen to 43. I got worried then. It was a wake-up call. And I thought, I have to do something about this. I can't rely on my GP actually providing necessary support. So I actually began to read around the subject. And I understood for the first time actually what those numbers meant, those markers, the HbA1c scores. I think if somebody had taken some time perhaps to explain that to me and the significance of that and where I was, I would have actually probably done something earlier.
Right. And so you were scared into doing something then, pretty much,
were
you, Anthony?
I was very scared because I became worried. I started to read about the consequences, some of the things you've mentioned already about, you know, heart disease, you know, loss of limbs, sight loss. And in fact, I did have an appointment with my GP and she said I needed to find a new hobby. You know, I couldn't spend all my time reading about diabetes. But that informed me about how I needed to change things. And I've now lost over 4.5 stone in weight. I've changed my diet. I eat very, very rarely do I have carbohydrates in my diet. So I've cut out potatoes, rice, bread most of the time. And I've eaten much, I'm eating much more sensibly. I would have believed before I was eating, you know, fairly healthily, but actually was it probably eating too much and not doing any exercise? And that those things have made a huge difference.
Right. So you took all this on board.
Yes.
And I can see you. You know, you look fit and healthy to me. Was that enough?
No, unfortunately, it wasn't, because I did the blood test in February and then I repeated the test in May. And actually, I was going to a hospital appointment at the time and a text came through from my GP surgery saying you're still pre-diabetic, and no explanation for how pre-diabetic I was or whatever. So actually I contacted the surgery, had a phone appointment, and they told me my score had fallen to 42. So I thought, well, I've got to still do something else about this. And prior to that, I had joined the NHS Diabetes Prevention Programme, which was something I'd heard about on the radio. I'd heard someone being interviewed about that. And I found out
radio is a wonderful thing, Anthony.
Yes, it was just fortuitous. I happened to listen to somebody speaking about it and decided to sign up for it. Again, you know, my GP surgery could have told me about the diabetes prevention program. That might have helped. And then I read an article in the Times newspaper about this research that was being done using this soup with a very, very high levels of I think it's glucoraphanine in particular.
I'm really glad you pronounced that word first. I was kind of waiting, hoping one of you would. But this has been presented as kind of the cavalry charging in to help at the last minute. So, Max, I can see you nodding. Tell us, well, pronounce it one more time and kind of tell us what it is and what it does.
Glucoraphanin.
Okay. What is it and what does it do for us?
Yes. Let me go back a little bit. There's been so much work done over many, many years on glucoraphanin in broccoli. Broccoli is one of those so-called cruciferous vegetables amongst watercress, kale, bok choy, cabbage, etc. Broccoli seems to be the top of the tree in terms of its glucoraphanin content. So what's good about glucoraphanin? Well, there's been over 3,000 scientific papers published in the last 30 years or so on glucoraphanin from broccoli, showing very, very clearly, Mike, that it has a lot of health benefits. A lot of epidemiological research, which is where they follow people over many years and look at their diet, has shown very clearly that high glucoraphanin stroke broccoli diets were associated with less cardiovascular disease, better control of blood sugar, i.e. anti-diabetes, mm-hmm. And also even protection against some cancers like prostate cancer, for example.
This is the subject of, you know, peer-reviewed scientific papers. It's not just some kind of massive punishment. If you've been bad, you've got to eat more broccoli.
Broccoli isn't that bad. The broccoli soup, I mean, I've tasted it many times now. The broccoli soup is actually a bit more like a vegetable soup. And I think most people like vegetable soup. But going back to the glucoraphanin, that seems to be the, I wouldn't say magic ingredient, but the key ingredient in broccoli. So what the Smarter Naturally company has done is to take broccoli and to actually make the glucoraphanin content higher and higher, just with a very simple breeding program. I mean, it was originally discovered about 40 years ago with Professor Mithun, who was doing his PhD.
So it's not genetically modified broccoli.
It's just normal breeding techniques, so nothing to do with GM, certainly not. And he found in Sicily quite a high glucoraphanin content broccoli. And since that day, with all the interest with the superfood broccoli, with all the health benefits, we've ended up now with a very high, probably about five times the level of glucoraphanin as in normal broccoli. How it works, without boring people with too much science, is when you eat the broccoli with the glucoraphanin, gets into the stomach, then into the gut. You have bugs called the microbiome, the famous microbiome in your gut that makes something called sulforaphane from the glucoraphanin. Okay, I don't want to get too deep, but it's the sulforaphane which is actually the nutrient which actually gives us these health benefits. So if you eat this high glucoraphanin broccoli soup, because we've turned it into soup to make it much more manageable, much more homogeneous or constant, you will actually get a good dose of sulforaphane, and that is the key nutrient which are going to give you these health benefits, especially lowering the glucose level in your blood.
Right, which is so vital. All right, so back to Anthony. Have you been doing this?
Yes, I read the article in the Times. I took part in a trial for a month, and then I signed up actually to buy the soup. So I've been having the soup weekly since June, and I did another HbA1c test last month. The score had gone down from 42 to now 39. So technically, I'm now no longer pre-diabetic.
Okay, so what's the cutoff? Is the cutoff 40?
It's if I'm correct, it's 42, isn't it, Max?
Yeah, it's about that. I think it's 42, 43. I mean, I tend to look at HbA1c in terms of percentage, but the trouble is you can get percentage millimoles or millimoles per mole. It can get very complex. But the important thing is to get that blood sugar down back into a decent, you know, low level. And if you don't, then it's you know, let's welcome diabetes. This is the problem. While you've got the chance to control it, you should. Once you get into diabetes territory, it's a little bit more difficult to come back. That's the problem.
Yeah. All right. So, Anthony, you're having this soup. How often do you have to have it?
Just once a week.
Okay, so it's not like something you have to have at every mealtime at all.
Once a week.
All right. And so, is it nice? What does it taste like?
Actually, it's fine. Yes, I eat broccoli regularly. It's not a vegetable I find particularly pleasant to eat, but actually the soup is very pleasant. I've not found it difficult to eat at all.
Okay.
Very palatable.
And I suppose even if you didn't like it that much, the alternative is, you know, diabetes or the odd bowl of soup that you're less fond of. Yes. There's no choice at all, really, is there?
It's no brainer, to be quite honest. You know, it's very easy. Just have it for lunch once a week.
Okay. So is there a cohort of people that are having this soup once a week and feeling the benefits? Because it sounds like, Anthony, you're quite good at seeking out cohorts of people that do stuff.
I don't know. Max may have more information on that.
All right.
Well, there's already been trials done, I think, on about 12 people over the last year or so. And every single one of them has got their HbA1c level to go down within 6 months, which I have to say I found extraordinary. Can I just make one other point, Mike, because it's really important.
Please do.
Now, we talked about diabetes. Nobody wants to go there. But currently in the UK, there's about 4 million people in diabetic territory. They are diabetic. The problem is there's about 14 million people who are pre-diabetic. And it's those people, probably about 20% will enter diabetes in the next 4 or 5 years, according to data. It's those 14 million people that really do need to somehow take action to try and prevent them getting into diabetic territory. We have 4 million in diabetic territory now. That's going to rise to 5.5 million even within the next 3 years. And that's really bad. This is, you know, it is really a big problem, diabetes, right now, and it's getting worse.
Right. So it's bad for the individual. But let's face it, it's bad for the NHS and really expensive for the NHS.
10 billion. That's how much it costs, roughly speaking, because, of course, not only is it treatment for diabetes, Mike, but also it gives rise to all these other problems we mentioned before. Retinopathy, capillaries at the back of the retina, you know, cardiovascular disease, metabolic syndrome, and even cancers are associated with diabetes. So we really do want people to take action themselves. Exercise, better diet, and again, this soup, Smarter Naturally, is available on the website as well, and it can do wonderful things.
Is there a way that people that might be on the verge of a pre-diabetic and they don't yet know, is there a simple test? Can people go to their GP or go to a pharmacist and say, look, I'm worried I might be on the verge of being a diabetic, I'd like to know? What can they do?
Yes, there are. There are a number of tests, but the simplest is as Anthony has already talked about, the HbA1c test. So what is that? It's basically a very simple blood test. You can get kits to do it. Your doctor might do it. The doctor may not do it. The doctor may say, well, you know, you need to be sick to attend the surgery, which I think is a little bit negative because, you know, they are overworked. They're concentrating on the sick people. Yeah. But there are tests available. You can get stuff on the internet, which is perfectly okay to look at HbA1c. And that
can you walk into a pharmacist and buy a test?
Yeah, absolutely. And I personally am a great believer in people doing these tests. I know there are some people who are anti this because it will swamp the NHS. But no, there are so many things that tend to go a little bit awry as we get a bit older. And wouldn't it be great if we knew about these things a little bit earlier? So we could then take action. It's like anything. If you get it early enough, you can take action and actually remain healthy.
No, that, absolutely. I'm with you. Now, if people are listening to this and thinking, maybe I'm in this situation where I'm a pre-diabetic or they just know a diabetic and they want to get some more information because, you know, there's a lot of misinformation around in all sorts of health spheres. Where are some really good sources of information and also some information about the broccoli soup?
Mm-hmm. Well, two things. First of all, information on diabetes. There's a wonderful website. If you just dial up Diabetes UK, that will take you to the organisation in the UK. That will tell you virtually everything you need to know and a lot more on diabetes generally, including the tests we just talked about. If you want to know more about this broccoli soup, which we've been discussing, if you just go onto Google, dial in Smarter Naturally, the smarter naturally. It'll be first up on the list. Just click it and it'll take you straight through to the website. And then if you want, you can purchase the product as well.
Excellent. So look, Anthony and Max, thank you very much indeed for chatting, because this is undoubtedly a very important topic. So many thanks.
Pleasure. Thanks.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Jake Dagger is a medtech expert and he's also the global leader at Rush Diabetes Care. I started my chat with him by asking him how big a problem is diabetes, read numbers, and the costs of diabetes.
So diabetes is a condition that is actually significantly increasing globally. In the UK itself, there's about 4.9 million people living with diabetes. So that's one in every 14 people in the United Kingdom.
Goodness. So if someone is sitting on a bus on the way to work and there's 30 people on the bus, there's probably two of them with diabetes.
Very much so. And close to a million people in the UK are living with diabetes but are not diagnosed.
Okay.
So this is this is staggering.
Yeah, this is a massive problem. And so what about the cost of all this?
The NHS spends about $10 billion a year to manage diabetes. So that's about 10% of the overall budget of the NHS.
Goodness. That's just an eye-watering figure. Terrifying. All right. So another question. You alluded to it a little earlier, actually. But is this a worldwide issue or are we just particularly unfortunate in the UK?
No, I mean, this is truly a wide issue. The situation is there's about 540 million people worldwide that are living with diabetes. Despite the fact that we have a very good healthcare system in the UK, we're not spared.
No. All right. Okay. So we've set up, there's a real problem to solve, to do something about. And as a medtech expert, you can help us. But I've got to say, this phrase medtech, I'm not sure, it's kind of new to me. Can you explain what that is?
Definitely. So medtech stands for medical technology. You have the pharmaceutical industry that is responsible for medication. Medtech looks after medical devices and diagnostics.
Okay. So as far as the work you do, I was kind of thinking it's probably where wearables that we all know about from kind of sports and running watches, that sort of thing, collides with medicine. And they kind of two are squished together to make medtech devices.
Yeah. So, Mike, what we have for medtech industry is essentially we have the wearables that many of us are familiar with, but you also have devices that are used to measure blood glucose or devices that actually deliver insulin, and those are the insulin pumps. So that's right, in the field of diabetes, that's more specialized devices that you have in the medtech industry besides the wearables, besides the digital apps or the digital platforms that are available as well to help people living with diabetes and their caregivers better manage the condition.
Yeah, all right. So you mentioned kind of two sorts of devices there. One that will measure blood sugar levels. Is that kind of implanted or do you strap that on when you wake up in the morning? How does that work?
There are different types of blood glucose monitors. There's the traditional, you know, device that actually you have to prick yourself, measure the blood, and do it on a single time use. Then you have the continuous glucose monitoring, which is a wearable. And depending on your condition, depending on your discussions with your healthcare professional, one of those two devices will be prescribed to you and you would be using it.
All right. So if you've got this thing that measures your glucose levels all the time and it's a wearable, how does that actually work? Because does it have to get to the blood in your body somehow?
Right. So essentially there's a device that gets inserted inside of your skin. And that is the where you have a small needle that sticks inside of your skin is measuring either the blood sugar or the tissues around where the skin is inserted. That device is either continuous, which means it's continuously measuring your blood glucose level, or flash, which means it's different times in the day you flash your device next to that inserted device, and you get the actual measurements of the blood.
Okay. So this thing, can you attach that to yourself or insert it yourself, or is it a doctor that does that?
No, once you're trained, you will be able to insert it yourself.
Oh, okay. So you insert it, and what, it stays there for a few days until it runs out, or a few months? How does it work?
Typically, it's about 10 to 14 days. That's the duration of the insertion, and then you need to replace it.
Okay, and that stays there while you're asleep, and you know, while you're having a shower, while you're doing everything?
As much as possible, yes. I mean, it's supposed to stay there, and that's the technology advancement. I mean, depending on how active you are, if you're a child, if you're swimming too much, if you're actually doing a lot of sports, it may get dislodged. But otherwise, yes, it should be staying there.
Yeah, okay. All right. So this thing is with you collecting data either all the time or a few times a day. So I guess the next question is, where does all this data go?
This is the important question, because measuring the blood glucose is one thing. However, what you're doing with the data is what matters. So essentially, the data can actually reside on the device itself. So you have an app linked to this device. But more importantly, if you want proper care for people living with diabetes, it's important for this data to actually make it to the healthcare providers. So the healthcare team can actually take better informed decisions around the condition that this patient is living with.
Right. Okay. So it sounds like the data allows decisions to be made both in the very short term. So if the patient sees that, you know, blood sugar levels are going very low, quick, you need to do something, you need to eat something. So that, you know, that has a feedback in like minutes.
That's right. It's a feedback loop. And it's important for the healthcare team to actually see the trends of your blood glucose level, not just a one point in time, but actually continuous and over time, to be able to assess truly how you're doing and how you're managing with your diabetes.
Okay. And so over time, presumably, this allows the patient to really change their lifestyle, change what they do, change, I don't know, when they exercise, when they get up, when they work, and when they eat.
See, having access to this data gives you a full picture of the health and the condition of the person living with diabetes. And it's important for the healthcare team to be able to monitor this over time so they can make the right decisions, be it lifestyle changes, medication adjustments, titrations, or different interventions that may be required for each person. So this is where having data and being able to measure it but also manage it is going to be critical when you're dealing or helping a patient live with diabetes.
Earlier in the chat, you mentioned that there was another sort of device that can inject insulin.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's right. That's called an insulin delivery system or the insulin pump. So this is primarily for people who have been living with diabetes for a while or are type 1 diabetics and require insulin injection to be able to manage the blood glucose level.
All right. So can the monitor can talk to this device and, you know, automatically you get injected with insulin at the right time? Is that how it works?
There are different ways of doing it. One is actually measuring your own blood glucose and adjusting the insulin amounts as needed. That, I would say, is the majority of people living with diabetes today. However, similar to what we discussed around data, the new approach of actually innovation in terms of in the field of diabetes is how can you integrate the blood measurement, the insulin level measurement, and then be able to adjust your insulin without having the person living with diabetes do the adjustment themselves. So this is the integrated loop that is now becoming more of an innovation and actually leads to better outcome for patients living with diabetes. Because essentially what it's doing is it's acting and responding almost instantaneously to deliver the right level of insulin as you need it.
All right, so there's kind of the patient is out of the loop. I mean, it's all happening to the patient and the patient has been monitored, but they don't actually make any decisions or have to do anything. It just kind of happens.
Actually, it's a very interesting play on words because it is called the closed loop system. So the point is the patient or the person living with diabetes may be thought about as not being involved. However, it's crucial that the person living with diabetes remains engaged with their condition and be aware of where they are in their journey so they can have an active discussion with their caregivers, because it's a collective team approach that actually leads to better outcomes with diabetes. But yes, to your point, there's less of an intervention with the person living with diabetes that is required as the new technology comes into play.
All right. So describe to us a little bit this device that can deliver insulin. Is this another kind of wearable? Is it, or do you kind of strap that on when you wake up in the morning? How does that work?
No, it is a wearable, and it's a device that you will have to wear, you know, almost 24 hours a day. So essentially, it is a device that is also inserted in your abdomen, for example, and it measures the insulin levels or the blood levels in your body. So as the measurements of the blood glucose levels are measured, be it through a blood glucose monitor, the response to the device itself, the insulin pump, is whether you need additional insulin, for example, that leads to insulin being injected into the body itself, or the person living with diabetes is the one injecting the insulin as required. But it's a wearable that has to stay on the patient for pretty much 24 hours a day, unless they're taking it off for activities or showers and what have you.
Yeah. All right. So this insulin pump, how big is it? And, you know, where do you put it? You put it on your abdomen or your arm?
Yeah. I mean, there are different types and different sizes. The newer versions are becoming smaller and smaller. So right now it's probably the size of half of a cell phone, but slightly bulkier. It is typically inserted around the abdomen for the most part, because you need the tissue to be able to stick it to a place where there's less movement and certainly for it to hold. So that's the pump itself. The newer pumps are slightly less inconvenient, where you have less tubes around the pump itself, so it becomes more convenient for individuals who are active. If you're doing a lot of sports, for example, the newer pumps can actually serve for that purpose. But the function of the pump is more or less the same, whereby you're measuring the blood glucose, and then as required, the pump is actually dispensing or injecting the right amount of insulin needed to manage your condition.
Fantastic. I mean, it sounds like this technology can just make a massive difference to people's lives. You know, this is going to turn people's lives around, isn't it?
So, Mike, it's important that actually people living with diabetes, or all of us, to have proper diagnosis and actually detect whether we are prone to becoming diabetics or not early enough. Because the early interventions, be it lifestyle changes or treatments or devices like we're talking about, actually leads to an improved outcome. So, yes, the new technology that we have today is doing, you know, quite a bit of impact and change for people living with diabetes. But the important thing here is that the sooner a patient or person is diagnosed with diabetes, the better the outcome, because better interventions can be applied as part of the journey.
Sure. Well, I wanted to ask you about that, actually, as what we've been talking about so far is treatment. But can this kind of technology help with avoidance in the first place? You know, is it useful to pre-diabetics?
You can certainly use the blood glucose monitor to measure your blood sugar and see where you are on the progression towards diabetes if you're prone to it. However, that's not necessarily a recommended use of the blood glucose monitors. A better approach would be to actually have the regular checkups with your healthcare provider, do the proper blood tests, and look at your history and also your whether you've got conditions or predisposed conditions to become a person living with diabetes. And that could be your age, your weight, family history, medical history, your ethnicity. All of those are preconditions for potentially becoming a person living with diabetes.
Okay. So as we said at the start, you know, this is affecting or will potentially affect an awful lot of people. So if people are listening to this and thinking, I need to find out a bit more, make myself a little bit more aware of the risks, etc., where's a good information source for them?
Yeah, I mean, there's a very good source in the UK called Diabetes UK. It's a charitable organization, and it has quite a bit of information and resources to learn more about the disease. If you are already living with diabetes, it gives you, you know, suggestions and resources in terms of how better to manage your condition. And it's also, you know, describes in detail the different types of diabetes and what it means and how you can go about getting treatment and support for your condition. The other site is probably the NHS Diabetes. That's a very reliable source. And I would say also the Roche Diabetes Care UK site has a lot of information for both patients and their healthcare providers. That certainly you can tap into it and get additional resources as needed.
Okay, three good sources there. So, Jade, thank you very much indeed for chatting.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Mike.
A big thank you to the guests on this week's show, and they were Dr. Max Goland, who's an expert in diabetes, Anthony Smith, he was a pre-diabetic who managed to head diabetes off at the pass using diet and exercise, and Jade Dagger, a medtech expert and also global leader at Roche Diabetes Care. And of course, a big thank you to you for listening.
That was the Relaxed Back UK show with me, Mike Dill. Thank you for listening, and please do join us again next time.